Good morning, everyone. I'm Kathleen Hicks. I direct the International Security Program here at CSIS, and we're so pleased to have you joining us today for this Maritime Security Dialogue. Before we begin, I just want to remind you that exits, should a fire alarm go off, are directly behind you. You probably will have to, it looks like, tackle some cameras to get there, but please, otherwise, walk as politely as you can to the exit. The Maritime Security Dialogue is co-hosted by USIS and our great partners at the U.S. Naval Institute. And our goal is to highlight current thinking and future challenges facing the Marine Corps, the Navy, and the Coast Guard. And our event today is the third Maritime Security Dialogue in our 2018 series, and we hope you're going to join us for our future events as well. We want to give a special thanks to Huntington Ingalls Industries for its support of the Maritime Security Dialogue, which makes the series possible. Today's discussion is with Vice Admiral DeWolf Miller, who is the Commander Naval Air Forces and Commander Naval Air Forces U.S. Pacific Command, and Lieutenant General Steve Rudder, who is the Deputy Commandant for Aviation for the Marine Corps. Our discussion today is moderated by my partner, Vice Admiral Pete Daly, Vice Admiral retired, CEO of the U.S. Naval Institute. And without further ado, over to Pete. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Hicks. We're honored to have these two panelists with us today to discuss our topic on naval aviation with a small N. And first, I'd like to introduce Vice Admiral Chip Miller, U.S. Navy. He's commanded at all levels in the Navy, started out in VA, went to fighter attack, commanded a VFA squadron, was selected for the carrier command track, then commanded USS Nashville, LPD 13, and ultimately commanded the carrier George H.W. Bush. As a flag, he commanded Carrier Strike Group 2. He participated in combat operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and has been the Navy's air boss since January of this year. To his right is Lieutenant General Steve Rudder, USMC, Deputy Commandant for Aviation. General Rudder commanded at all levels in Marine Aviation, coming up through the Marine Light Attack Community as a Cobra pilot. He has command experience spanning from Desert Shield, Desert Storm, all the way up to Iraq and Afghanistan. He commanded Marine Light Attack Helicopter Squadron 167. He deployed to Iraq in command of Marine Air Group 26. He commanded the 1st Marine Air Wing in Okinawa. And he's been the Deputy Commandant for Aviation since July of 2017. So I'm just going to get right into questions and give more of a general question to be the icebreaker. So first, for Admiral Miller, you know, the GAO report from September 2018 looked at Navy and Air Force aircraft, and they reported again that between 2011 and 2016, we've had a decline in operational availability, mm-hmm. and also an increase in ONS costs. And less than a year ago, your predecessor, Shu Schumacher, testified that not even a third, or about a third, of the Navy's 542 Super Hornets could fight tonight, and only about half could fly. And you've cited recently the unacceptable number of long-term down aircraft. How are we doing to regain track on readiness, and can you outline your plan for that?
Yeah, no, great question. And that is the question, and it's not. It was interesting, you know. Prior to becoming the air boss, I was at director of air warfare in the Pentagon, where we were putting together the budgets for the 18-19 budget. Which now I have the opportunity to put into action. And so I will tell you that the inside the beltway look, at least mine at the time, was that hey, you know, we're going to be able to quickly restore readiness and then start growing our Navy. And what I discovered when I got out to the Air Boss, and it's been 9 months of discovery, is that hey, the hole's a little deeper than we thought. And this, you know, we didn't get here overnight, and we're not going to get out of it overnight. But I'm glad you used the word plan, because that's exactly what we have. So first, let there be no doubt, I own it. Readiness recovery, that dot is on my forehead, and I own it. I'm the supported commander for that. And I'll tell you, that's that in and of itself, having a supported commander and supporting commanders for this plan is critical. Otherwise, you just have people within their own stovepipes doing their own, what we've been doing, and it's not a change of behavior, which is going to, no kidding, accelerate the readiness recovery. So when I say that, Vice Admiral Peters at NAVAIR, Admiral Skubic at NAVSUP, Lieutenant General Williams at DLA, they are all supporting this readiness recovery effort for us. So that's one aspect, is the entire Naval Aviation Enterprise being aligned towards that recovery. Another thing, it got to the point where if you ask different people in either of those organizations what they were, you know, what are you measuring, how are you measuring what you're measuring, you would have gotten all sorts of different answers, and no, the left hand might not have been connected to the right hand. What you have now is simplified metrics that all map towards, for the example of a Super Hornet, 341 airplanes. That's what we need. And you're right on the numbers. We have improved since Admiral Shoemaker's testimony. We're at about 50%, whether you're looking at total active inventory, just a little below. If you're looking at in-reporting, a little bit above. But we're around 50%. Still not where we need. We're at about 260 airplanes on average, and we need 341. So simplified metrics and aligned NAE. That's really important. The other thing is just a sense of urgency. So that sense of urgency has been imparted in all those organizations to get after, you know, in accelerating what it is we're doing to, in order to achieve those up airplanes. So one of the things we found, it comes down to people and parts. We brought in data analytic teams to take a look at our business and tell us, you know, hey, where do you think those levers are that if we pull these levers, we'll get the maximum rate of return and be able to start accelerating our efforts. And it really came down to we need more parts in our systems, in the overall system, and then, you know, airplanes break. And so we need to be able to accelerate our ability to repair those parts. So our fleet readiness centers, both our depots and our AIMDs, we need to be able to expand our capability, our capacity, and we need to accelerate the return there. And so we're implementing a new system called the Navy Sustainment System. It is going to leverage the best practices from commercial industries. And so we're in phase zero of the Navy, instantiating the Navy Sustainment System right now, which is a 30-day look at our fleet readiness centers, at our depot, at how the entire supply system feeds into that. And I'm convinced that when with all those things and all the enablers that I just described, with underpinned by this new Navy sustainment system, that we will rapidly achieve the results that we're looking for.
Okay, we'll come back to some of the details of that. Thanks for that overview. For General Rutter, about a year ago, the Commandant was our guest in this program, and he cited the fact that we were behind where we needed to be in the readiness of Marine aircraft as well. And he also specifically said that he was not fully satisfied with the condition of even new delivery aircraft, that they had too many things on the list as delivered. Could you give the kind of that parallel answer on where you think you're at with respect to Marine readiness for aviation?
Thank you. And thanks for all of you for being here and what this organization does to air some of these wonderful issues, I guess. You know, when we were working this a few years ago, we made the commitment to do a couple different things. And one of the first things we had to do is fully fund our accounts that are directed at keeping aircraft up. And we did. And just as some examples, our FRCs. We didn't do our FRCs any favor. We are now fully funding FRCs to hire back the people that we lost during those critical years, in the 13, 14, and 15 years, 16 years. We gave NAVSUP money so they could increase the level of spares that is required to fully stock our shelves. And in some cases, we had to revise our model because sometimes your sparing model doesn't exactly comport with what you're seeing on the flight line. So we have a technique called customer-oriented leveling technique that we're starting with the V-22 right now, and it's simply an Air Force model that allows us to keep, with, you know, basing up the CV, keep higher levels of spares in the system, and as you go down to a certain percentage, it sends that demand signal to NAFSEP so they can refill. I mean, just simple things like that. Also, for our program managers, Dino Gordon, Vice Admiral Dino Gordon, we're funding our program managers so they can go out, either redesign a part or put more effort into the programmatic side of it. And one thing that Chip and I did is we agreed with Dean to put more emphasis on the program managers, to hold them more accountable for, with the funds we give them, for putting those funds towards the things that would help a particular community to dig itself out of a readiness slump that they have. Some of it's just simple things like getting with our industry partners and going, hey, we're gonna hire some training aspects of industry engineers to put on our flight line to help a young Marine or sailor work on a particular complex system. Because all our systems are complex, and we still have 18 and 19 year olds that we bring off the street that we have to train to a certain level so we can go train and fight with them. Those are the three things. And of course, we put money back into our flight hour program so we could fly. I'm happy to say we're not where we should be, but we are seeing some increases. We are seeing those percentages of mission-capable aircraft come up. And just as important as a metric, you know, in 16, our pilots were averaging 13.5 hours a month. In 17, it was 15.4. Closing out 18, our pilots are averaging 17.9. So our readiness is creeping up, but more importantly, we're becoming a more ready force. And quite honestly, what we're doing is we're flying more airplanes and we're really taxing the system. But I think the system's where it is. It will take time because some of our aircraft are old and some of the parts that we're now buying are kind of what we would call long lead items. But I'm confident that we're moving in the right direction. Part two, your question is new airplanes.
Right.
I can only say that if the taxpayer gives the Marine Corps a new airplane, we're going to use it. So just think about this data point with the F-35 right now. We have 33 operational F-35s. 22 of them are forward deployed right now. And it's still a growing community. And they're deployed two different places in Asia and a different place in the CENTCOM AOR. Talk about that supply chain in a growing new system. 2007, we didn't think we could do it, but we did it anyway because that the operational environment demanded it. We deployed our MV-22 squadrons. Before they were what some would consider ready to deploy, we deployed them because that's what the warfighter needed for it. Go back to the question of, are we satisfied with some of the readiness levels of our new aircraft? We're not. We're satisfied with the capability. We're working that capability hard. Sometimes you don't know what you're going to break until you put it in the hands of the warfighter. But I can tell you the new airplanes we're buying are very capable. Are there components that need to be potentially looked at for a higher usage rate, a redesign? Of course. But the statistics will tell you that with any new aircraft, you can only test it for so long before you have to field it. And once you field it, like the F-35, we've got 155,000 hours on the F-35B. We are still learning things in that aircraft. And temperatures you couldn't replicate in the Middle East. You can't replicate that in Pax River or in the desert of California or in the operating environment off the ship. So we are learning things, but I'm happy to say that industry and the program managers are working these, and we're knocking these things off as they go along.
Didn't we have the first combat mission from F-35B last week?
So I hear from the press. We had the first combat mission.
I guess my attempt to get more information on that is not going to work.
We also had first F-35B land at Queen Elizabeth, which is a UK ship. But we're very very proud of that partnership as well last week.
I'll tell you, if I could add, I know you asked the question, Chip Miller, Navy, Steve Rudder, Marine Corps. Let me tell you that we're together. Our trends that we're seeing are exactly the same. We're both supported by NAVAIR and those FRCs that we talk about. So the efforts that he's working on are the efforts I'm working on. The efforts I'm working on are the efforts he's working on. And I'll tell you, it's one team moving forward. And when you talk about what we're sending forward,
right,
those deployed forces are absolutely the best trained, best equipped, ready to fight tonight.
Well, in that vein, are you getting, I mean, the Marines are ahead of the C, the F-35C with the B and the B deployments. You mentioned, well, you didn't specifically mention, but we've got WASP and Essex out there in one other location. But is the Navy taking advantage of some of the learning? I mean, I know it's a different aircraft in a somewhat different environment, but there will also be some real lessons there.
Absolutely. So our very first F-35C squadron is in its transition right now.
Right.
And in Lemoore, matter of fact, they just accepted their first airplane. And that first deployment will be on Carl Vinson in FY21.
Right.
So we're taking lessons not only from the tactics development folks at MOTS and at Top Gun, to the airship integration efforts between what we're learning on our amphibs and what we need to apply on our aircraft carriers.
Great. Shifting gears a little bit, you know, we've had the Naval Aviation Enterprise for, gosh, I think Admiral Nathman, it goes back some 17, 18 years now. And one of the features of that was this concept of ready for tasking. And for the people who don't live it and breathe it, essentially ready for tasking was that the aircraft could do the thing you needed it to do for that mission or sortie that you were asking that moment, and it was ready for tasking. Up until that time, we'd been heavily reliant on metrics like full mission capability. Well, now that we're emerging from this permissive environment, and the strategy explicitly calls out, you know, great power competition, are we going back to full mission capability? I had a lieutenant tell me he was flying off an aircraft carrier. He was flying a CAS mission, so his RWR gear, his radar warning equipment, that didn't need to work because he's doing a CAS mission. And then he said he saw other things fly by and he wished he'd had that. So my question is, are we reevaluating RFT in view of where we are today?
I don't know what RFT is anymore.
It's gone?
FMC and MC. We're making sure that our airplanes are ready to fight.
Okay.
We're all about great power competition and fighting at the high end. And I'm a simple guy. Push forward, big trees, pull back, little trees. This whole, we were getting ourselves in do loops as far as our ability to explain tiered readiness, how we measure that readiness. It's going to be very simple. I either have an airplane that's ready to fight or not.
Yeah, let me also add on that, when you talk about we're kind of leaving this low threat in these environments, we are currently in a, you know, high threat environments every day. We have our fixed wing, Marine Corps land-based expeditionary fixed wing assets up over working CENTCOM AOR, and when you go out and you go into that environment, make no mistake about it, you are in a complex environment when you're over the, in places like Northern Iraq or Syria. There is no, you're not getting a free pass in those areas anymore. Everybody has got systems which challenge you on a daily basis. So we're already there. And if you are flying in Asia right now, whether you're doing a training event with one of our partner or allies over there, you are in a complex environment where you have to have those systems operating in your aircraft. Are there challenges to those systems? You bet. Are we addressing those? Yes, we are. We're well into this thing. I know we keep talking about moving away from the low-threat environment. Yes, to a certain degree, but we're in it today.
Right. Understand, I don't worry so much. I don't worry much about you guys, but in a large bureaucracy, when you send a signal for years that you have a certain level of effort,
right.
And you know the Secretary of Defense wrote that his kind of budget outline. He said we're going to do readiness for a couple years, and then we're going to be at the high end. Well, my question really is: has everybody else come along for that ride? The people who do contracting, the people who deliver spares and equipment and equipage that our forward Marines and Navy airmen need.
Yeah, so great question. We're not there. That's the sense of urgency that leadership is trying to impart to everybody that has anything to do with readiness recovery, with doing their business.
Right.
And a lot of it is culture. We've kind of taught ourselves since sequestration in 2013 that, hey, this is what I do, these are my habit patterns, and we're trying to say, no, that's not quite right. We need to raise the standards, we need to accelerate timelines, and we need you to approach business a little bit different. And that's our challenge, is to impart that sense of urgency, because that's what our country needs, is our ability to fight and win at the high end tonight.
Roger. For General Rutter, the Marines reshuffled their F-35 transition plan to emphasize replacing the Hornets faster. And as a result of that, I think there was a trade-off where we also held on to some Harriers a little longer. Your predecessor, Doug Davis, said that if the Marines could really get the F-35 faster and transition faster, there was the potential to save a lot of money on avoiding maintenance for legacy aircraft. So in light of that, how are the Harriers holding up? And is the Marine Corps still accelerating, and are you satisfied with the pace?
Yeah, for the record, it's never fast enough. You never have enough jets. And you'd always like to transition faster. Some of that, those limitations, is just how you transition your force structure. And as we do transition, I'm always reminded, as I look at our deployment cycle and the global force management aspect of this, we're doing this in stride. I mean, you can't not do a deployment or go to combat because you're transitioning a new airplane. So much like the squadron, F-35 squadrons that are out there transitioning now, that timeline is such that you've got to get them ready to go, because they are getting ready to go, in some cases, in the direct combat. So yes, we are balancing our F-18 and our AV-8B transition cycle. With the Navy exiting out of their legacy early, allowed us to have an opportunity to really look at what we would call inventory management, taking the best of breed, taking those high lot number aircraft, putting them through the depot cycle, putting them through a rework cycle, and outfitting our fleets with a higher lot number F-18, which will allow us to kind of be at the edge with as a legacy Hornet can be, of a war-fighting environment. So getting F-18s down a little quicker allows us to kind of manage that inventory a little more effectively. And we also have, inside just managing an older airplane, we have efforts out there to increase the capability of the radar, increase the capability of the aviation aircraft survivability equipment. So we're managing that effort as it goes along. So you're balancing that. So, yeah, the F-18 was a good we had some squadrons that had F-18 A++s that we needed to retire. And that squadron seemed like a good time to transition that squadron to F-35B. So we kind of reshuffled a bit. AV-8B, we are at 5 operational squadrons right now. Getting out of one of those squadrons early allowed us to reshuffle aircraft. So now each of the squadrons are back up to 16. The program manager is doing a great job keeping that aircraft flying. Our industry partners are doing a great job keeping it flying. But we are working, though, if you are working that community on that aircraft. Right now, it's got more capability ever had before. We just put Link 16 on it, so it's going to have a Link 16 on an AV-8B, which it never had, believe it or not, as a TAC air platform. And it's going to continue to go back and forth to combat like it's doing now. So we're watching it closely, obviously. We think that we still got to about 2026 to keep the AV-8B around. If you are a AV-8B pilot right now, you're at what we call 1-2 dwell, which you are deployed for 6 months, home for a year, deployed for 6 months. So we're working them hard, but those aircraft, it's a workhorse aircraft, and I'm very happy to where we sit with it right now. But some of the older F-18s, we needed to reshuffle those squadrons a bit to get out earlier.
Thank you. Just to shift gears a little bit to people and talent management, one of the things I had the privilege to do when I was a captain is I was the EA to Admiral Fargo at PAC Fleet. And I remember distinctly a discussion that he had with Admiral Nathman at the sea cabin one day. We were in San Diego, and Admiral Nathman was explaining to my submarine four-star boss, our submarine four-star boss, he said, we have a situation at Lemoore we started asking questions about the rag, and all the maintainers were getting out. And Admiral Fargo said, why are the maintainers getting out? Well, because they're working late. Why are they working late? Because they're moving parts from aircraft to aircraft. And, well, why can't we just get them the parts? Well, it's not so fast. And there's an engine backlog. Why is there an engine backlog? And after the whole discussion of explaining the air boss, explaining this to his, you know, nuclear submarine four-star boss, you know, it became clear, and he revealed his ideas for an enterprise approach to solve all this, and it became NAE. And some of the stories that you're hearing even today kind of remind you of that movie.
Very similar.
And so I was just going to ask you, where do we stand on talent and talent management, both on the maintainer side and then also some of the, you know, the pilot communities like on the Navy side, you know, VFA comes to mind.
Right, you bet. Well, I don't think we're different than most businesses from the standpoint that if I join an organization to do something, right, I expect to do that something.
Right.
And so whether I'm a maintainer working on an airplane, I expect to work on airplanes and have a good, decent quality of life. If I'm an aviator, I expect to fly and you know, earn my craft. What I'm getting to is the question you just had on retention and people and how are we doing, it is directly related to readiness. When I have up airplanes and we are flying them, we have happy folks. And I will tell you, from an aviator standpoint, most of our communities are doing pretty darn well. Where we are challenged is exactly where we're challenged in readiness, which is mostly in our strike fighter pilots. From the maintainer side, and I'll talk then about what we're doing about it. On the maintainer side, it's similar, but what we're doing is we're doing fit and fill, and we're moving. We're taking a helo guy who grew up being a helo maintainer, and all of a sudden we're saying, hey, we need you working on F-18s in Lamar. Same story that you had before. So we need to build that aviation maintenance experience within a squadron and give the sailors and Marines the tool sets they need to be able to succeed. And so that's where our efforts are. It's working on the readiness piece, which obviously will have a direct impact on the retention. From the officer side, you probably heard of a new program. We're just having the first board actually next month, where we're going to have professional instructor pilots in Meridian and Kingsville. We're going to select 30 people off of this next board. And so if you're post department head, you want to, we got guys, maybe I don't want to be a command, or I'm not in the running for command, but boy, I really like flying airplanes for the Navy and I'm a pretty good instructor. We'll let you do that to the end of your career. So right. So that's a unique program.
Just to jump in there, you said Meridian and Kingsville.
So that's where we're starting.
That's my question.
Yeah.
Well, do you ever foresee that extending into the FRS squadrons?
Don't know. I do see it expanding into the HTs. So for right now, I'm thinking Sinatra, whether it goes into the FRS. Right now, I don't see it going there. If we get ourselves healthy through Sinatra, I'll be, we'll let this continue to grow here for a while. We'll watch it, we'll assess it, and we'll continue to grow it.
So sorry, interrupted you.
No, that's okay. I'll give you another, the other thing with the officers, just increase educational opportunities, career intermission where, hey, I just want to take a break because I've been working really hard. I used to not be able to do that. You can do it now and come right back in and just start. Maybe you went back a couple year groups, but you're fine. You aren't going to lose anything. Mm-hmm. So those sorts of career opportunities and flexibility, we think is going to help out quite a bit. And we also improve flight pay and bonuses as well. So that's how we're addressing on the pilot side. On the I'll give you a story that we're doing in Lemoore, again, a pilot program that we expect to expand, and it's called NAMSE. Many of you probably remember the old SIDLMs that we used to have for maintenance experience. So let's say I'm a sailor in Lemoore and I'm in a VFA squadron. The only option I have for shore duty in Lemoore is the FRS. And the FRS, quite a bit of it is even contracted. So the number of billets that I have there, it isn't great. You mentioned earlier about the number of long-term down airplanes. Okay, well, let's come up with a way to solve both of these. increase maintenance experience for our sailors, and work on long-term down airplanes. So we created an organization called Naval Aviation Maintenance Center of Excellence. We're going to give these guys patches, like they're top gun, top wrench guys. And they're going to, now all of a sudden, I leave my fleet squadron, I can go over there and be a top wrench, and I can work on long-term down airplanes. I can stay in Lemoore, so it gives my family stability. And what I'm doing, though, is I am turning wrenches and gaining experience on F-18s. I roll from that unit after having continued my experience level, and now I go back to another fleet tour right there. So the next one's going to be out in Oceania, and then we're going to start expanding from there. But it's going to provide our sailors greater experience, it's going to make them more competent, and we're going to set them up with the tools to be able to be really proficient in their craft. So kind of I weaved around your answer there, or hit it on various points, but definitely actions that we are taking and doing and putting into effect now for our officers as well as our enlisted, and we're already seeing the benefits of both of those.
You mentioned the tide readiness, and General Rutter mentioned this, but are we getting enough on the Navy side? How about hours per month, and are we getting the right hours per month?
We track the exact same things. And we're looking at the same thing as far as hours per pilot per month, and same trends that the Marine Corps is seeing. We're moving in the right direction.
Okay, thank you. For General Rutter, is going to give you a crack at that same question for Marine aviation talent management, both on the pilot and the maintainer side. Any trends that you see that are reported, you know, that you need to report on?
Yeah, we actually, in the Marine Corps, stood up a talent management council led by our assistant commandant. And one of the topics on that was not only pilot retention, but the entire chain of pilot production, whether you're assessing, where you assess, how many people you assess, and then where the barriers are. And both Bullitt and I both are, you know, anxiously kind of looking at the training pipeline, especially for TAC Air, as they go through, to try to shorten that time up to get those young pilots out to the FRSs and then get them to the fleet. So we've got that whole thing, all the way to the retention. The retention model takes on many different variations. If you're a young man or woman pilot, you want to fly. You want designations, you want to deploy. If you're a mid-range instructor, you may be flying too much. If you're a senior major, lieutenant colonel, and now your kids are at some age where you have to make family decisions, and you're deploying again and again, because we have not stopped in the 16 years at war, we have not stopped our deployment cycle, that may be a factor. So we're addressing all those factors. We're getting people flying again, we're getting them up airplanes. We are looking at our depth, the dwell, when you are home and how when you're away, and managing those particular assets. We've done a few things to shuffle some units around. So we're looking at that. And at the other end, there should be no doubt in anybody in here that when the economy's good and places like the airlines are doing really well and you've got a demand signal out there, that is lucrative to some of our aviators. So, giving them incentives, I believe that if you're a Marine, you should want to be a Marine forever. I mean, this is what it is. But that doesn't work all the time. So we have to treat each and every case. Certainly, some of it has to do with balancing a monetary value like a bonus or a duty station or an aircraft that they fly, or giving that family potentially a break, whether it be at school, come to the Pentagon, Headquarters Marine Corps, it's a wonderful place to be. Or otherwise. So we're looking at all how we manage that talent. Back to the enlisted. The enlisted, we are focusing on, one, the training. And that, I think, mm-hmm. Bullitt talked about that. We 18, 19, 20-year-olds off the street need to be able to work on an F-35, V-22 within their, five-year, six-year enlistment, whatever that is. And we got to keep a certain amount in. We need to keep those guys and gals in as they progress out. So one of the things that I think is critical is you find that qualified Marine that has those higher level designations. You want to reward him. And in the past, before last year, we never really had a reward. It was just like, okay, you've got a higher level designation. That just means you're working this weekend because you're the only guy that's got that designation, guy or gal. Now, we have reenlistment opportunities now. So if you're a collateral duty instructor or collateral duty quality assurance representative or some of the other designations, you want to reenlist, we're going to give you money for that reenlistment. And we're also going to let you stabilize in that particular squadron or another operational squadron for 2 years. Now, it doesn't seem like much, but we've had some success with people take that on top of their reenlistment bonuses that are already available out there for some of the MOSs. So if I want to stay in North Carolina or California or Hawaii, I reenlist, I get $20,000 per year for 2 years, and I get to stabilize my family there 2 years. And now we're tracked them by a number, a military occupational specialty number, so now we can see where these people are and manage that community much better. But make no mistake about it, for Bullitt and I, one of our greatest challenges, we love our pilots. We want to make sure that we have the best trained force in the world, but equally spend just as much time as that sergeant, corporal, mm-hmm. petty officer down in the garage who's really doing the yeoman's work, keeping our airplanes flying. So that's something we cannot discount in our country throughout the Joint Force.
And we noticed something, I call it a discovery as we go out and visit our bases, and no kidding, go from that Pentagon view
to the
reality, if you will. We noticed that our AIMDs, was wondering why we have a lot of apprentices and not many journeymen. So just start saying, why is this? Well, because the sailors were getting, and Marines were getting, two-year orders. It takes about 2 years to graduate from an apprentice to a journeyman. About the time they were getting their skills as a journeyman, we were transferring them out. We said, no, you now have four-year orders. And so now we're actually training them, using them, developing their skills before we send them out. It makes them a lot more valuable and makes them a lot more, they feel that value that we have in them.
I'm going to ask one more question and open it up to the audience. For General Rutter, right now, I guess WASP is in Singapore, the WASP ARG, and Essex ARG is, I think, in the Gulf of Oman. And both of those big deck amphibs obviously have F-35Bs on board. And one of the questions, it's just great to mark the moment that it's making these incredible ships all that much more powerful. But one of the items about the F-35 is C2 offboarding information, sharing it, networking it effectively. And I know there's some classified aspects of that, obviously, but could you just talk about the early progress that you can report on, and how is that going, the integration between the F-35B, the ship, and maybe the other ships?
Yeah, the first thing is, broadly across the naval force, is just be able to push information and be able to push the level of information you need. And it's not, quite honestly, it's not limited to just F-35. It's limited to all the information we need to coordinate a larger warfight amongst the naval force. That's always going to be a challenge. For the F-35, we're having great success with the Link 16 out there and making sure the information gets down. We're having success with being able to transition that data, which can be at a higher level, out to broadly across all the forces that are on the ship. We are not quite there yet. We do have an initiative, it's a Marine Corps initiative inside the program, to be able to put full motion video earlier than later inside our jets, so we can at least continue. Full motion video is still a very viable thing to have in attack air platform, so we're working to do that. So we've got work to do, and some of it has to do with just the ability to get the systems that we want out there, connect the aircraft to it. I think one of the, getting away from the shipboard environment, because we're having success with just basically operating the particular airplane, is when our last weapons and tactics course out at Yuma, we were able to connect the F-35 to a HIMARS, to a rocket shot, and we were able to target a particular conics box in the ground, one of our ranges, transition that data back into the system to the HIMARS battery, and we were able to effect a direct hit. And this was all done through just data link, just pure data link. So that's where we're going, the rapidity of how fast you can transmit data down to the shooter, right? Sensor to shooter, And the F-35, we're getting it. We've actually, within the Naval, we've got to kind of catch up with that jet, and we've got programs in place to do that.
Okay, thank you. So, as promised, I was going to open it up here. How about this gentleman right here in the blue shirt? And just please identify yourself and sure. Ask a question.
Hi, Justin Katz, Inside Defense. Thank you. Admiral, if you could speak a little bit more about the Navy sustainment system you mentioned at the start. You know, specifically, what are the goals of that, and why is it different? Certainly, your predecessors have looked at the FRCs. They've looked at leveraging industry. Why is this effort going to, you know, move the needle in the right direction? Thank you.
Yeah, good question. We are at phase zero right now, which is really the discovery phase. What I will tell you is that we're bringing in what's different this time is the expertise of the outside industry that we're bringing in. Another thing that's different is this is supported at the highest levels of the Department of Defense. So that gives me confidence that as we elevate barriers and as we require changes in policy or law, that we will have complete support moving forward. So that gives me great confidence, as well as this system is a proven system. It's worked at, without getting into the various companies and airlines, but it absolutely has. And when the experts walk through our FRCs, they walk through and say, wow, we see some good here, but overall, we can make changes quickly. And they already have in some instances, and they've really only been at it for a couple weeks. So we're going to report out at the end of this month, back up to the again, highest levels within the Department of Defense, and then we're going to get after instantiating and putting into place their recommendations. It will be shared across all of the FRCs, both at the Level 3 and Level 2 at our depots and at our AMDs. And then initially we're starting off with Super Hornet, but trust me, this will rapidly go to all type model series in both Navy and Marine Corps.
Okay, this woman right here.
Aloha.
Here, wait for the mic. It's right here.
Aloha. Alelo Channel 49, 53, 55, 54, Hawaiian Islands, all Hawaiian Islands. Part of the Chinese arsenal, aviation arsenal, is the Chengdu J-20, the Shengyi J-34, the AG-600, and then the Y-20. I'm particularly in Hawaii. How do we preserve American aviation security against the cross-border intellectual property theft from China, given that China's cyber hacking centers are less than 5,000 miles away from Hawaii?
Stick?
That's a great question. It is a concern for everyone. It's a question that has many tentacles, and I can't speak to all the tentacles, but I do within industry, within our program offices. There are many different things that we are working on to protect, whether it's hacking, cybersecurity, our cyber protection teams that begin to look at all our networks that are working that problem every day. But I can tell you it's a problem that's not going to be easily solved, and a problem that we're going to have to keep pace with just as much. Whether you're in Hawaii, and I just came from Hawaii last summer, so I'd like to go back and see you sometime again. But it's a problem that we'll have to keep pace with every jet or ship or weapon systems we have. That cybersecurity, that piece will have to be one of the lines of effort that we'll have to keep pace with for a very, very long time.
And with respect to your intellectual property aspect of the question, it's not just military. It's also our industry partners, because they're as vulnerable as well. And so this really is a team effort to stay on top of.
Okay. How about right here, and this lady with the glasses there?
Thank you. Jia Cheng with United Daily News Taiwan. Admiral, according to the CNN recent report, that DOD has a plan to warn China and conduct sets of exercises in South China Sea and Taiwan Strait. I know you are not able to respond to the future plan, but this has raised concern that Taiwan Strait may be the next flashpoint. Would you provide us information of how you would maintain the peace and stability in the Strait? Thank you.
So I'm not going to speculate on, you know, potential future operations. What I will talk about is our mindset, if you will. My job as air boss, as the TICOM, is to man, train, and equip deployable, combat-ready naval aviation forces that win in combat. So that man, train, and equip. We spent a lot of time this morning, at least initially, talking about readiness. That's that equip part. But the training aspect of training for whatever possibility our naval forces would encounter, be it in that AOR or elsewhere, is smack dab into our portfolio and how we do that. And I mentioned earlier, I'm confident that our forces that we send forward right now are absolutely ready for whatever could come their way. So without speculating about how we employ our forces, what I will tell you is that training is good today, but it needs to continue to evolve and pace whatever threat we may face. So with that, our ranges, live, virtual, constructive, the way we train forces, and you know, as General Rutter talked about in Link 16, the entire tactical grid that we use and how we fight to that is going to be critical to our future training and future scenarios. And so it again is an emphasis that we aren't just sitting here looking at how we're training today, but we absolutely have an improvement plan for the way we train for tomorrow as well.
Okay. How about that lady standing on the side there?
Thank you. Tara Kopp with Military Times. For Admiral Miller, could you please give us the number of flight hours per month for your strike fighters, what they're averaging now? And then for both of you, you know, 2017 was a tough year for military aviation, particularly for both of your services. What is 2018 shaping up to be so far based on the numbers you are seeing?
I'm sorry, the second part of your question, what numbers?
For the mishap rates for 2018, are you seeing an improvement, or will it be a few years the money and whatnot to see some real improvements?
So one difference between the way General Rutter does his flight hours per pilot per month and ours is the fact that we do tiered readiness. So what we allocate for our deployers is different than what we allocate for those in maintenance phase. So the question goes, what I can tell you is we're improving, whether we're in maintenance, basic, integrated, advanced, or deployed, which are kind of our OFRP, our Optimized Fleet Response Plan. We have increased our flight hour per pilot per month in each of those bins here consistently. It's consistent with the number of up airplanes that we have and we provide to those to the squadrons as well. So I'd have to break out the papers and give you exactly what those numbers are, and I'm happy to do that. I don't have it off the top of my head, but I do know that the trends are absolutely in the right direction. An area where the trends aren't in the right direction are, so what I will tell you is Class A and Class B mishaps are very consistent with previous years. Our Class C aviation ground mishaps are going in the wrong direction. And so it is clearly a focus area. Readiness and safety are the two things that dominate my time. On the safety, we've attributed, and I think folks have testified to the fact that a lot of it comes down to supervision how we're supervising the work that we're putting our sailors asking them to do. Part of it also, I think, has to do with less reps and sets. So as readiness increases, reps and sets will increase. I think that we'll approach it. But I've personally sent out a message to all of my commanders talking about this, that we need to change some behaviors. because what we're doing right now, the trends just continue to increase. So maintenance controls, our chief petty officers, we've challenged them to get more involved into every single maintenance action, every single movement of an aircraft, to be able to turn the tide and get those. What I will tell you is FY18 ended up pretty much exactly where FY17 was with respect to those safety trends, but they're nowhere near where I'm happy with them.
Okay.
Yeah, for us last year, I mean, we had a terrible year last year, and this year we cut our mishap A, B, and C in half. So we didn't have a great year, but we cut everything in half, and we're still concerned about making sure the pilots are trained. We never, in some cases, never really connected the readiness levels or the pilot flight time to a particular mishap, but we fully understand that reps and sets, flight time, allows that pilot to react differently. And I'll give you an example of a 53 that caught on fire last year, one of our first of the fiscal year, and the pilot in command had 23 hours in the past 30 days, and that aircraft was on fire. The crew was fighting it as she was flying it, trying to get it back ashore, and she did a wonderful job, did everything the way it should be, and everybody walked out of that aircraft unscathed. So we see little pieces of that, which leads us to believe we want pilots to be proficient so they can react well to things that are unforeseen in the and within aviation, within the operating environment. For the ground piece, we cut those in half as well. Some of it had to do, as Bullitt said, with just pure supervision, where we really put some things in place, just simple things like increase the level of oversight of towing aircraft, because we were having some towing instances, whether they were bumps at night or banging things against another aircraft, just things that just were not the right way to do business. So we are at the 3- and 4-star level, and our wing commanders at the 2-star level. We are digging down into every movement on the flight line to try to prevent those. But again, we were below average this year for Class A, and I'm not exactly happy with that. Never like to lose an airplane, but we recovered a bit from last year. Thank you.
I will tell you one thing that I've instituted recently that I hope will have an effect. Before, let's say, a community had a ground mishap, of course, they would investigate it and do whatever they needed to do there, but those lessons would be shared within that community. We're now sharing lessons. These need to be shared across communities, across coasts, whether it's at sea to all the carriers or ashore to all the bases, so that we're maximizing our learning from these, but also making sure that it's not just awareness, but we're going to do something differently as we move forward.
This gentleman up here with the...
Good morning, Otto Kreischer, Sea Power Magazine. For Admiral Miller, the Navy is responding to Secretary Mattis' direction, is going to the dynamic deployment thing. We saw it with the Truman in and out doing different things. In the past, we've done something similar, and we ended up with maintenance problems because we interrupted the cycle. Are you at all concerned that you're preparing your aircraft, your squadrons, to go if we get into too heavy of this dynamic deployment cycle? You're going to have problems keeping your airplanes on the maintenance cycle. And for General Rutter, one of the Marine Corps, during the time that the budget was tight, we lost a lot of our ground maintainers. I assume that's one of your major efforts, is to rebuild that cadre of kids on the flight line. How are you doing on that?
Yeah, so I'll go ahead and start on your first question, and no, I'm not worried at all about that. And the reason is the OFRP we qualify squadrons and ships to go forward, and that enters the beginning of their, if you will, employment phase. So we've got them through the force generation, and now it's time to employ those forces, and they're ready to go. And that phase continues, and we keep them manned, trained, and equipped throughout that employment phase. Historically, though, what have we done? You finish up COMP2X, the next thing you know, your next time going out to sea, you're going on deployment, and 6, 7, or 8 months later, your deployment would end, and then you'd, you know, go into sustainment phase. All we're doing now, so from the my perspective of manning, training, and equipping those forces, what we do with them in that window is up to the force employers, the fleet commanders. And so that's our job really hasn't changed. The time frame that we have to keep them at that state of readiness really hasn't changed. And so as long as we're staying inside of those windows, even though we're being less transparent with how we're employing our forces and keeping our adversaries and potential adversaries guessing, that's all okay because we're able to maintain training and equip those forces during that time frame.
Yeah, I think to your question very briefly is, you know, when we surged and grew the force during the time where we needed it, when we were, we had a lot of people deployed in different parts of the world. On the backside of that, as you begin to readjust the force, the readjustment becomes very complex when it comes to accessions, retention within individual MOSs. And I think your comment was exactly right. We potentially, in some areas, over-adjusted in some key MOSs, which allowed us, we had some missing higher level rank structure, sergeants, staff sergeants, that were allowed to leave, and you know, great heroes. We let them, but then we didn't really have that accession model to bring that, to grow that force in a balanced manner. I'm not an expert on manpower models, but that's where we are right now, just trying to rebalance that after we came down from 202.
Okay. How about right here?
Hi, Basil Gray with Gray Areas LLC. I understand, you know, throwing more resources at the problem is a potential solution, getting more people, hiring more parts. But what I'm interested in is how are we leveraging technology to overcome some of these old processes? And I'll give a couple examples. The last time I saw demand plan accuracy was in the 20 or 30%. So buying a lot more of the wrong parts doesn't necessarily help us. It's a waste in cost. And then repair turnaround time is long for a number of reasons. So how are we using artificial intelligence, additive manufacturing, and PBL, and even a change in CONOPS using unmanned systems to reduce demand on our aging systems?
Well, I think you answered your question. The answer is absolutely we're using it. I'll let General Ryder talk about additive manufacturing because he has some real good examples on that. With respect to data analytics, I think I mentioned earlier that we're incorporating data analytics into a lot of what we're doing. So with respect to, and I'll give you a couple examples, the long-term down airplanes in Lemoore. So the way we used to distribute parts is against an airplane. So let's say you're a squadron and you have an airplane and it's down, it just needs one part to be able to fly. And I'm a squadron and I have an airplane and it needs two parts to be able to fly. And one of those parts is the same part. If this squadron ordered it first, what would happen is that part would arrive and so it would go to this squadron over here. But oh, by the way, their next part isn't going to arrive for 6 more months. So now you end up with two airplanes that can't fly for 6 months because of a long time. So we're now using supply optimization tools that are taking a look across a base. And not only a base, but across a type model series. So I use Lemoore and Oceania as an example. And so, okay, a long lead time part is coming in. What airplane benefits the most from that? And so that's one area where we're using, you know, data analytics to help out making what I call data-driven decision making. On the predictive side, we sent, as we were looking at what levers do we pull for readiness, we had an AI. We didn't tell the program what to do. We just said, gave it a bunch of historical data and said, you tell us where you think we need to look. And it's the one that pointed out with, hey, it's your aviation depot level repairables at your AIMDs is where if you're able to improve the throughput in there, and it gave us different percentages, which ties to different funding. So if you're able to improve your throughput there, you will see this many more sustainable aircraft. And the second area it pointed, so ABDLR, RFI percentages, they're ready for, you know, getting
depot
it back.
Depot level repairables.
Depot level repairables at our AMDs, because that's the quickest, most rapid ability. Airplane breaks, or part breaks, get it fixed, back to the squadron quickly. The second one was our manning, the sailor manning in our squadrons, because that also comes, we tier that as well. And so they're saying if you're able to improve that, those two things simultaneously, this is what our model predicts. And so what are we doing? We're testing out that model by implementing the Navy's sustainment strategy, improving our manning at our squadrons, and we're going to see how accurate that model is. And then the model itself will continue to learn as we expand that model to look at other aspects. You mentioned unmanned, and I don't want to anchor too much on this, but clearly our Navy and Marine Corps aviation is going heavy in unmanned. For us, Fire Scout, Triton, and MQ-25 off of our carriers are going to be a huge part of how we operate in the future, and I'll just leave it at that so that General Rutter can give some examples himself.
There's, beginning really with the FRCs and the processes that go into play there as far as cold spray, build a mill, aluminum. I mean, there are so many. And this is where, you know, fully funding the FRC is producing some good things. Just having the technology within the machinery in there to be able to produce the parts that are required for throughput. But back to, I think one of the things is this as manufacturing thing, we're at the front end of this. For the past year, we have submitted parts for additive manufacturing approval. There's the parts that require an airworthiness approval, and then the non-airworthy approval. The non-airworthiness is kind of easier to do. But I think for this audience here that you're going to see additive manufacturing, both in industry, inside our FRCs, the Air Force is ahead of us on metal printing. You're going to see that really take off. That's just at the beginning of stages. I just give you one simple example. V-22 ICS box. If you had a knob which controls the volume in each one of your radios, if that knob broke, you had to go out and order and pay for a new ICS box. So with a polymer 3D printing process, you can now print your own 10-cent plastic knob to put on that particular item. That's just one small example of where I think we're going to see a lot of cost savings. Now, we're going to have up front to get the machinery to do it. So polymer is a little bit easier, and then metal printing is the next big piece of that. Pitch change links, engine links in the V-22 that we're printing metal. A little more complex, a little bit more approval required. But I think you'll see in the next year, if we're back talking to you all the next year, you're going to see additive manufacturing be kind of the headline of how far we've come with efficiency in the FRCs and certainly in our out in the field, because we'd like to be able to print these parts all over the while we're in combat or anywhere we're forward deployed.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. This gentleman right here.
Thank you, sir. J.V. Venable, the Heritage Foundation. Question is to General Rutter, sir. I think you're probably familiar with the Air Force state of affairs with regard to flying hours. It comes down to reps and sets. This last year, General Wilson mentioned that the average fighter guy got less than 14 hours, something around 13 hours, and that actual average holds through to about March of this year, and the statistics beyond haven't been sorted. What was troubling is when you go into the data, you find out that the average F-35 pilot got somewhere less than 7 hours a month all year long last year. Could you talk to us about where your F-35 guys are and how many hours, how many reps, how many sets they're getting in the B model?
Yeah, I would have to give you, it's higher than that, but depending upon where you see a particular organization, when you average out your organizational load of hours, many times when you're standing up a squadron, putting new pilots in, that squadron is on the road to safer flight. So the averages of those pilots are going to be smaller. And as you build up to that squadron, and right now we have VMFA 122 that's in Yuma right now, they're still in a transition process flying airplanes. Deployed units, those averages are going to be higher. If you're VMFA 211 off the ship in the CENTCOM AOR, you are flying more hours than those in the rear. So we're still very junior when it comes to F-35. We have a training command. We've got 22 airplanes, four deployed, and we've got one operational squadron that's just now transitioning up into a deployable unit, and they're not close to that yet. So I would only caution that we've had really some good months with all our F-35 pilots, but we had some of those that draw down our average with some of these transitioning pieces. But I take that question very sincerely, that we are making sure that they do have. And we can't forget about F-35 is a very simulator-heavy aircraft, too. So a lot of that hours now is being flown in the simulator. But we don't discount what they're going to need to be in the seat to do that.
Okay. Well, on behalf of CSIS, Dr. Hicks, and the Naval Institute, we want to thank our sponsors, Huntington Ingalls Industries, again represented here by Admirals Donnelly and Fox. And importantly, we need to thank our speakers here today who gave their precious time to come over and give us all this information. So for Admiral Miller, General Rudder, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.